Welcome to ITE2, Module 8, Part 2. And we're very delighted today to have Elise Lonsdale doing Part 2 of the ITE Module 8 as well today. So thank you, Elise. And just before, as a little treat, we thought we would read you an article that went into our Southern Gazette community newspaper here in Perth. And it's a story about the CAVI, where we're trying to get funding for next year, as we all know, and we thought we might just read that to you because it was a good article. So here's over to Sue Murray.
Yes, we can.
Thanks, Sue.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, no, we just thought you'd be interested to see. We are working on trying to get some publicity over here and to keep the course going. Otherwise, we're all going to be out shaking, rattling tins.
That article sounds like it's pitched to the common person, so it's not sort of going into what at all. So it's good.
Yeah, it's building public awareness, which is what we want. Yeah. Okay, Elise, over to you, my dear.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, one and all, to ITE Chapter 8, Part 2, because we didn't make it all the way through last week. And that's because there's quite a little bit involved. Just to recap, we learnt about installing a NOS, or a network operating system. In particular, the notes refer to Windows 2000, but I did try wherever possible to relate that to Windows XP. Some of the knowledge in this actual module will also help you if you choose to do Linux, as even though the operating systems are very different, some of the principles by which they operate are similar. For example, they all have an installation program, they all use the common protocols like TCP/IP, they all manage multiple users and run services or daemons in the background to perform certain tasks. So last week we got through the installation of the operating system. We talked a little bit about the usage, the Windows desktop environment, and we talked about some of how JAWS and other screen readers may relate to that. Then from there we moved into starting to set up user accounts, because all operating systems, all network operating systems, do rely very heavily on user accounts. And can anyone remember one of the most important things about a user account other than the username?
I'm not supposed to answer, but the password?
Wow, yeah, the cyber lollipop to carry, there you go. That's exactly the answer I was looking for. The password is...
Lollipop.
And if Chris gets one right, we'll send him a cyber donut. The password is the easiest, the most, I guess, in-your-face way of authenticating any user to a computer, whether it be a small computer or a larger corporate system. And we discussed some of the rules of passwords, and I won't ask for too many questions here, but we basically discussed how that we would want to make them more than 5 characters long and preferably use a combination of letters and numbers, while at the same time trying to maintain a balance of what's an easy password, or what's a password that sort of makes sense to you and remembers, or that's easy to remember, but also harder to crack or harder to get past if you're an unauthenticated user. There are people out there who tend to name them after their cats and dogs and wives and fathers and mothers and children, and if you happen to know what they are, they're passwords that could potentially cause you to have difficulties. And also dictionary cracking programs can often work those out. So it's always good to try and maybe mingle an uppercase letter here and there and have some sort of numerical value in there as well. At this point, as I scroll down, does anyone have any questions on last week's module that they may wish to have clarified as I just move on to the next part of the notes? Well, silence is golden.
I was just going to remind people that, just as a general announcement, that at the end of the week we have 2 weeks without students. That is to say we have no official lectures planned, but my guess is if you lot are all as behind as I think you are, you'll want to use those 2 weeks to catch up. So we will be available on Skype and available for to talk to in those 2 weeks if anybody needs any help with things.
Thanks, Kerry. And I've been going through the labs, and I have actually got some of it done, which is really cool. And I've noticed that a lot of the labs are really good. They pertain a lot to this chapter, this particular chapter. I was actually doing the user account one last night, and it sort of really is good if you can get into the labs, because they'll sort of give you a practical demonstration of how it all fits together, as well as reading the notes.
Yeah, and can I just mention there too, sorry.
I was just going to say that the labs are actually a required component, so if you don't get into the labs, you're not going to pass.
Uh-huh. And there are not just worksheets, there are labs as well, so yeah, be aware of that.
Yeah, there was some discussion on that last week. The worksheets were already converted to Word, the labs have been converted to text, or you can access them from the PDF, whichever is
so
your preference.
So you all should be doing labs and worksheets.
And if you don't do your labs and it gets to November and you go, why can't I pass? Well, sorry, we're going to have to tell you that you're going to have to go back and do all of the labs. And I'd strongly recommend that you do 48 labs over the next few weeks rather than 48 labs in 2 days. That sort of cramming will not give you knowledge that sticks.
And also your instructors will have a heart attack.
They will. I'm trying to do at least 3 a day, and that should take me through to next weekend or the week after with the schedule I've got, and allows for a little bit of variance if I get held up or something. So yeah, just do a couple of the nights or something if you get a chance. Okay, the notes actually tell us about the different groups. When you install Windows, as you will remember, you would have been asked for the administrator's password. Windows by default creates the administrator account and adds it to the administrator's group. And this is so that you've got somebody with administrator rights to administer the machine. There are other types of administrators I won't go too much into. I would ask you to refer to the notes. There's a domain admin, or domain administrator. It will actually add those automatically. And there is an enterprise admin. Now, the enterprise admin's really if you're going to be using or administering a domain or a group of machines. Whether you're actually put into that by default or not, I'm not sure. Oh, boy, I just lost my notes. Oh, dear. How does that work? My mouse has gone into zooming rather than scrolling. Okay, we'll get rid of the mouse. That's
when I start to sing. We have some waiting music.
I think you have to have a bit of scrolling because of...
La 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 la.
That's why it's also important, just for people who are doing lectures and things, make sure you scroll with the keyboard, not the mouse, because if you hit a key and you've just been scrolling with the scroll bar, it will bounce back up to the top.
This is when we go
okay,
scrolling,
we
scrolling,
unplug the mouse.
Scrolling.
Scrolling. Okay. Okay.
No, just as long as you remember to click every now and again, just to actually move the insertion point.
I do. I've never had this problem before, to be honest. Play is a combination.
Take your time, no panic.
Did you end up getting window eyes down, by the way, Elise?
No, I'll fix it. I have got it there to do, and every time I look, because I was going out when you sent me that last week. Okay, we're at the top.
That's okay.
Out of the notes. I will do it this afternoon, actually.
Okay, so basically your default users, you've got things like power users, you've got backup administrators, you've got printer admins, you've got... I'm just filling in CRUD while you're finding your notes.
That's because you don't want me to sing.
That's exactly right, because I don't want her to sing. You've got things like power users are the ability to change the priority of various processes and things. Backup administrators obviously can administer backup media and stuff. They have the permission to insert and remove backup media and those sorts of things. Interestingly enough, one of the first things you should do when you install Windows NT is rename the administrator account. Because everybody knows that the administrator by default is administrator, and you might want to rename the administrator, say, Donut Boy or something. So you don't want your administrator account to be easily guessable. Okay, cool. And I can stop rabbiting on about user accounts.
Well, it's good advice, actually, because you usually have to disable the administrator account. Now, actually, while I've got everybody here on this point, I've noticed that under Windows XP, this is all a lot simpler, or virtually hardly there at all. Am I correct?
No, the groups are all still there. And if you go into the user manager in Windows XP, it is all actually there, like it is in NT. The administrator account is by default hidden on the welcome screen. And there are two ways. In fact, it mentions in the notes how to get into it. There are two ways to get to that account. One of them is to go to www.myfavoritedgatesingsite.com and applying a registry hack that will unhide administrator on the welcome screen, or you can do that with Tweak UI.
Yes.
Or if you're sitting at the welcome screen, you can press Ctrl-Alt-Delete twice, and you will actually get the traditional username and password login box thing,
which is much nicer. But what about all those power users and different groups that we were discussing in Windows 2000? Are they there? I don't think I've ever seen them.
They certainly are. If you go into the user manager, the group, there are some of the groups there. And in fact, if the only reason you don't usually see them is because you create yourself as a system administrator, so you're a member of the administrators group, therefore the rest of the groups don't really matter. It's only when you start to become paranoid like they do here at the association and you don't give all your students administrator rights on the workstations because you don't trust them, which is understandable but quite annoying, that all these groups come into play and you find you can't install the latest version of Winamp and you can't install Windows Update and do not go past Go and do not collect $200, basically.
Sure. All right, well, that's all good. So there you go. 8.4, managing the file system, and it drops briefly into this because it actually talks about creating shares. One of the first things an administrator will need to do is actually log on to the system and create certain folders on the server that will be shared out to users across the network. They will choose a name for the directory, they will create their directory, and then they'll right-click on the directory, or for us, we'll probably Shift-F10 on it, go to Properties, and then go to Security, and then select which permissions or which users and groups have access to that share. And then from there, it's basically so that you may create an accounting group, and you may wish to keep the engineers out of that particular folder. So everything that goes into the accounting group or the marketing group won't be seen by all users of the company. So basically, if you're in a... Go on, Kerry.
I was just going to make a point here to say that be aware that if your file system is NTFS, you will be able to set both network permissions and file system level permissions, but if your file system is FAT32, I don't know why it would be, but if it was, you would only be able to set networking permissions. Don't confuse share level permissions with file system level permissions. They are both applied, and the least match wins. So you can let people in through the network permissions, but the file system will lock them out, and vice versa.
Yep, that's good. Thanks for that, Kerry, because it can often be tricky. Now we talk about the actual groups. And one of the labs that I did last night was I had to create a engineering group and a marketing group, I think it was. And this is in lab 15 or 16 or 13 or 14 or somewhere about there for IT2. And Geraldine obviously hasn't read it yet because she would have loved some of my comments. Because... this is where the labs are really good for practical use. You can simply say, well, we're not going to allow the marketing people into the engineering group. Or the marketing people you might be able to create a user, like user A1 or user A2 or whatever it is, and assign them access to both groups. If you create a directory and you assign that directory, allow it to be accessible by, let's say, the marketing group, and you have a user that's in the engineering group, but you want to add the user to the marketing group, that will therefore become that folder will therefore become accessible to that member. So it's a good thing to get familiar with. Have a play with it. If you've got your virtual machines, create some users as per the notes, delete one or two, and you've probably, if you go by the notes, you'll end up sacking the whole engineering department. So there you go. You can have a lot of fun doing that. Particularly good for managing large amounts of users on the network. Now, there's actual local groups here it starts talking about, and I'll refer you to the notes for that.
The difference between, just to briefly summarise, the difference between local groups and global groups is that local groups are local to the machine that you create them on. They are local to the machine that you create them on. They are local to the machine that you create them on. Don't ever forget this. Because when you are using multiple NT servers, if you are going to authenticate against six different machines with six different sets of local groups, you better make sure the passwords are all the same, or you're going to have to remember which password needs to be used on which machine. Whereas a global group is a group that is actually inherited through the domain and Active Directory structure.
Thanks, Kerry. Yeah, the notes here seem to be going back on themselves a bit into passwords, because it's talking about passwords and permissions. So it basically touches on what we're doing here. Make sure your passwords... Now, permissions are restrictions created by the system administrator, which will basically allow the administrator to have full permissions to everything on the system. And as I've just discussed, in the notes, it actually gets you on the labs, it gets you to create a marketing and a engineering folder with certain permissions. And you get to learn some of the permissions. Now, based on our previous knowledge, what are some of the common permissions you can set on a file or directory? Any takers?
Read, write.
Somebody's got read, write,
and execute.
Execute, that's exactly right.
Well, they're the Linux permissions, but the NT's got a few more.
Yes, it has full control.
List
and
folder contents.
Wonder why.
It also has full control and change.
And change, yes. So there you go. So, do you want me to read out what they all do, Kerry?
That's probably wise, actually.
Yep, no worries. With the read permission, this is the ability to read the contents of the file or directory. The write permission, which is often referred to as change or modify, this allows the user to modify or change the file and to add files to a directory. Execute permission allows you to actually run a file within a directory. Now, it just basically says that above permissions can be assigned to any of the groups or users that we've already previously mentioned. It doesn't actually talk about the full control and the... Kerry?
No, full control basically gives you the ability to perform any action on a particular file, so that's what full control means. And in fact, full control overrides any other permissions that are set on the file for that user. There is actually a set of precedence rules for NT permissions that you need to be aware of. And so, for example,
Yep, no, that's all good. We've pretty much come to the end of that section. We're going to go on to services and things next. So does anyone actually have any questions to ask Kerry or myself regarding users or groups or permissions or any of that sort of stuff?
I've got a question. In the Windows NT permissions, you've got your five read, write, list, folder contents and all that, and you've got allow and deny checkboxes. What's the difference between not allowing something and denying something?
That actually makes a difference if the permissions are inherited down from the folders above them. For example, often if you set a file on C:\donuts, and then you've got a subfolder that's cream filled. So if you set the permissions on C:\donuts/cream filled, you'll find that permissions are actually inherited from C donuts. So if you actually want to block somebody out of cream filled because you want all the cream filled donuts for yourself, you actually have to deny the permissions that would automatically be inherited down from the folder above it.
So basically, I'd be allowed all the donuts except the cream filled ones.
Essentially, well, if you actually were blocked out of that folder, the best tool to read about permissions is a thing called CACLS, CACLS, which does not mean we sit there going. It's actually a command line ACL control tool, and if you read the help screen for that, it'll demystify a fair bit of that. But yes, you actually have to explicitly knock out permissions if they are inherited from the folder above them, which is why you've got deny checkboxes. And apparently these ACLs are POSIX compliant, so you can go look up the POSIX ACL spec if you got nothing better to do on a Sunday afternoon.
Okay. Any other questions on permissions before we jump into services? Okay. With any network operating system, it can be set up to run programs in the background. And we've had some discussion on this before. In Linux, they're called daemons. And in Windows, they're called services. And an add-on to Windows can be to install certain services and to get it to do extra things that may otherwise not do when it comes out of the box. One of the services that you'll become very familiar with is with the Internet Information Services, commonly referred to as IIS. And this allows you to set the machine up as a web server, where pages can be served out over the World Wide Web, an FTP server, and a couple of other things. The labs do get you to install the web server, and that's why Kerry has made available to you I believe the ISO images of the... I actually just got in the cupboard and got my Windows 2000 disk out, but I do believe that you are supplied with the Windows ISO disks from which you can install add-ons. Is that correct, Kerry?
That certainly is, and in fact you are provided with the ISO that you can attach to the virtual machine with the CD-ROM, and once you've attached that you can then add components in such as IIS, which was the explicit reason why I did actually give you the Windows Server 2000 ISO, otherwise I wouldn't have provided it at all.
Well, there you go. Has anyone had experiences of, particularly with say Windows 98, 2000 or even XP, just adding in extra services like basically when you go into the control panel, add remove software, and you go into the add remove Windows components tab. Has anyone had experience and played with that?
I have, but I don't think I can.
Yes, exactly. Well, there you go. You can join me in the insanity group then. Okay, basically that's what you'll
can
be asked
to do. Can I join too?
You can, my dear, yes. We've all had experiences. Obviously, a few of us have had experience in adding and taking away Windows components, and it will at that point prompt you to supply your Windows XP or Windows 2000, whichever operating system you're working on, CD-ROM. Or in the case of the ISOs...
And there's a problem here, and I've seen a lot of people do this. They go, "Oh, I'll just install that network card again. I do not have the Windows CD because my mate's dog ate it. I will just point Windows back at /Windows/system and it will just copy the same drivers in again. It will all be good." And then they wonder why their registry scrambles and their machine comes down in a screaming heap. If the drivers you copy in the first time are corrupt, you cannot point it back at its own copy of the drivers to copy them in again. It just won't do it. And I think... one of the general points to make about Windows is there is a lot you can get away with Windows, and we call degatesing, where you change a lot of the look and feel, and you change a lot of the way you
make it usable.
Make it usable, yes. Although keep in mind that if you are going to make modifications to the operating system that are not Microsoft recommended or approved, you do run a very slight risk of your system behaving somewhat erratically, and as a person who is willing to make those changes, especially those who are willing to edit the registry and that sort of thing, which you do have to do quite legitimately on a number of occasions, you do take that under your own risk, and you as a technician must be aware of the ramifications of doing that. But there is certainly a lot of fun to be had if that's the sort of thing you're interested in, which is why you've got virtual machines to try it on first before you bring down your regular machine nastily.
That's right. So the main thing we're going to learn about is IIS, installing Windows information. So, what's IIS stand for? I've had a mental block. Internet Information Service.
Internet Information Service.
Server, yes, which is, I guess, in Linux. Kerry will be doing a lot of discussion in future weeks on Apache. And so once it's installed, you then need to configure it. And the notes tell us, very simply, once you start it, how do I normally start it? I normally go start programs and administrative tools. And that may not always be on your start menu, so you may have to come coming through the control panel, but it is under the administrative tools. And once you get into IIS, it's basically one of these windows that has two panes, a tree view or list view down the left-hand side with things that you can expand, and the other right-hand side of the window has the things that are in it. So a little bit like Internet Explorer, Windows Explorer, I beg your pardon. And basically the notes are telling us, because I do actually have it on another screen, select the machine name, do a right arrow, or click on it, or click on the plus if you're sighted, do a right arrow if you're blind, and you will see the services that you've got for that particular machine. One of those services is HTTP. You'll have a default website. If you expand the navigation tree down, you'll be able to drill down to the default website. Some of these properties are fairly self-explanatory, but some of them will require an experienced administrator to make them run.
Is that once you have customized all of these properties, unless you have DNS functional on your network, you will have to access your web server based on its IP address. A lot of students get stuck on that, even the instructors sometimes, when we were going through in the instructor classes.
Yeah, it's a quick note that I've got. I was actually doing this last night, and I couldn't get to it. I went to another machine, and I was typing in the IP address of the actual machine. Now, we're running under virtual machines, and in one of the early labs, you'll have an exercise where you'll have to manually configure your TCP/IP settings. My suggestion would be, after you've completed that exercise, put them back to dynamic and allow your virtual machine to go wherever the DNS server in the VMware tells it to, because then you will see your website, as I did last night. I set one up. Now, from the local browser, you can type in once you've got all this configured, type in http://127.0.0.1, which is the loopback address for that machine. But you can also type from another machine, if it's accessible from your network, the http://, whatever the IP address and of that machine. So, no, go away.
That'll be the phone.
That'll be the phone. It's not going to get answered. Sorry, guys. I didn't set the time out for the... there you go, it's gone to message bank. Sorry, Kerry.
I was just going to make a point here that if you're mucking around with your virtual machines, and we do encourage you to muck around with them, unless you actually set your network type to bridged, you won't be able to access it from another machine on your network. You'll only be able to access it from the machine that it's on. So if your networking is set to host only, you'll only be able to access the machine from the... you'll only be able to access the guest from the host, or from itself, whereas if it's set to bridged, you should be able to access it from any other machine on your network. So bridged networking means that it becomes another machine that exists on your network, as in it's as good as any other machine. It shares the network card, but it has its own IP address and stuff that's handed out by your DHCP server. But if the networking is set to host only, the only machine that can talk to a host only network is the host machine and the guest machine that can actually talk to itself. So it's a network that is internal to the box you're working on.
That's handy to know. Thanks for that, Kerry, because I was going to go to the land room and try it from the laptop, but it was getting too late and I couldn't be bothered, so it probably wouldn't have worked. So thanks for that. So you can just get IP config to tell you what your IP address is on the guest machine, and go to your host machine and type in http://. One of the other things to be aware of, the notes didn't tell us to do in the labs, is that set a default page. By default, any web server will look at, in Linux land, it's usually index.html or index.htm or something. In Microsoft land, it's usually default.anything. Default.asp or default.htm. I wasn't seeing what I was hoping to see, so I just got on my... Actually, funnily enough, I got my virtual machine to make a connection to my Linux server and drag down a heap of HTML from a website I was actually working on, so it wasn't too complicated. Put it in there, went into IIS, set the set the default page to index.html, and it worked perfectly. So just be mindful of that. The labs may forget to tell you that, and you'll start seeing some things like page cannot be displayed, or this website's under development. So make sure that the file, make sure that there is an index file in the root directory. And I think for memory, it is /netpub/root or something like that the IIS goes to, but you can set that anywhere.
Yeah.
So
the other thing I was just going to mention too is just be aware, and this is an issue for web developers just to be aware of, Windows is case insensitive but case preserving, which means to say that the file index.htm all in lowercase will also be found as index.htm all in uppercase. But Linux is actually case sensitive and case preserving, so if you've got capital I on your index.htmls but the files are actually in lowercase, the web server won't find them. So probably keep everything in lowercase unless you've got a specific reason not to, otherwise it'll break when you move it between systems.
Yes, very, very, very good point. Now, I've taken over websites that have been knocked up with front page, to put it nicely, and I've gone and I can't see this page, and I've been putting the, you know, migrating the website to a Linux machine, and that's one of the common things you'll find. Okay, the notes now go on to say setting up an FTP server, which is also done with IIS. We won't spend too much time on this, but the procedure is very similar. It tells us to install IIS, and once IIS is actually started, it will actually start serving out FTP. Now, it's been a little while since I've done this, and I haven't got up to that part of the labs yet. Actually, that was going to be tonight's job. So I'm probably going to go through a lot of memory here, but if I remember rightly, the FTP stuff was very, very similar to setting up HTTP, wasn't it, Kerry? You just nominate a directory.
The labs will take you through that anyway.
The labs will take
you
through.
If you're doing the labs, they will take you through, yeah.
Okay, well, I've got a note here to myself to ask for comments on how to remove components, which we've spoken about before. Okay, so we'll probably let the students go through the labs on that. The next part of it is the tab... is to setting up Telnet in the notes, and again I might get us to go through the labs because there's quite a number of those I looked at when I was...
Yes, please, everybody try and catch up with your labs because we're getting worksheets but not necessarily labs, and this makes a lot more sense when you're following along and doing your labs at the same time.
The other thing is, if you come across a lab that you can't do, don't just stop dead. Go and find the labs that you can do. Go through all the labs that you can do first, especially if we're not available for questions. And then if there is a lab you can't do, we are actually available on Skype, and we say this every week, on Skype, to help you with those labs where we can. We're certainly not going to do them for you, but we'll get you out of the bad stuff, so to speak. And make sure that you do those labs, and there are labs for discovery as well. And whilst a lot of those labs haven't been converted, there are some that are doable on the pods, the hands-on labs, and the weeks are ticking away. And if I don't see those labs, I can't pass you, and Geraldine can't pass you either.
We all think you're wonderful people, but we still can't pass you. We need to have the labs as well as the worksheets. It's very, very important. And if you leave it all till the end, you're just going to be overwhelmed because there's, as we mentioned, there's 48 labs for IT2 alone.
And Chris is officially not wonderful because he hasn't submitted his labs yet for Module 10, so there we go.
Well, there you go. I must admit to being a little bit behind on the IT and CCNA, I beg your pardon, but IT is going good. One of the things I've noticed, just to back all this up, is that once you've... the more labs and worksheets you do, the easier the whole thing becomes because you've learned stuff. And there's
unless
a lot of
cross-over
in these courses.
Unless you're doing the hands-on stuff, it's just a whole lot of theory. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. Once you start doing the hands-on, okay, that makes sense.
I found that the more you do, the easier they are in a lot of respects because there's crossover and there's stuff that, particularly when you're doing the labs last night, to finish getting my HTTP server working, I just used a lot of knowledge I already had previous to that particular lab. So the more you do, the easier they become in a way. Okay.
And they're fun.
And they're a bit of fun because you go, oh, I learnt that in last semester. I can try and apply that now and see if it
and
works.
And you think, I didn't know how to do that, and, good. Now
those cavvy instructors aren't so mad after all.
what we also find is that there is actually, and this is an extension thing that you can do after you finish your 48 labs if you've got any energy left, there is actually an integrated package for Apache, PHP, and stuff that is just like a next, I agree, next, finished wizard that will actually get Apache and all of the LAMP stuff, as in Apache, MySQL, and PHP, all up and running under Windows. And that's all a bit of fun to play with if you feel that way inclined.
And just as a little reminder too, that there is a practical exam for ITE2 that you have to pass. So unless you've done the labs, you're going to have very little, if any, chance of passing the practical.
Also be warned, the practical exam is set to work on a Debian box. And in fact, I've installed a thing called DWWW. Say that 10 times fast. No, don't, because we don't have time. And you can actually go to the IP address of your Debian box /DWWW and read all of the documentation that you will need, including the readme files and man pages, in a web browser. Yay!
We don't get that under Fedora.
No, that's right. So, and you can actually search and everything. There's a little search box, and you can go submit, and it'll find things for you. So, certainly have a look at that, the DWWW stuff. You can do the final practical under Red Hat, but let me assure you that there's going to be a lot more work for you to do dragging down all the correct RPMs and stuff. We have actually keyed it up to behave pretty well under Debian with the packages that Debian provides in the practical final. And we may write a Red Hat version, but I don't think that's going to be easy because the version of Red Hat we've got is so old we may not be able to get
Fedora,
RPM
I suppose. I think it's a good excuse to learn a bit of Debian or maybe install Ubuntu when the next release comes out next month, because both Red Hat or Fedora and Debian are releasing newer versions of themselves. I think it's in October, so there you go, good reason to get in and get some Linux installs happening if you're game enough.
Well, in fact, Fedora releases come hell or high water. And in fact, my honest suggestion to you is wait a couple of weeks after the Fedora release for the dust to settle and yes. Find out what broke in this version. However, the Ubuntu ones tend to have a feature freeze and they're usually pretty good. But yes, there is a Ubuntu 8.10, which is Intrepid, and that should come out probably late October. It's based on the Launchpad freeze schedules. And that'll be a newer version of Orca with Firefox 3 and all those sorts of fun things that are accessible. So for those of you who are feeling game, it's all happening in October.
Get your removable hard drives out and start installing, which is what we'll be doing in late October, I can tell you that. But back to Windows. Those operating systems, of course, as we've learnt from previous lectures, have the ability for you to telnet in. Well, Linux has the better ability for you to SSH in. But Windows does provide a telnet administration server. It's not part of IIS, but it is in under... Go ahead, Kerry.
Just going to make a point. You're absolutely right. However, Windows Server 2008... If you install Windows Server 2008 Core Services, you actually get a command line interface only, and access to that command line interface is done using SSH. So there you go. There is third-party SSH for 2003 Server, but Core Services, you actually have SSH by default, and you can do everything from the command line in 2008 Core Services, or you can do it from what we call PowerShell, and that's certainly something that students should take a look into at some point. PowerShell runs under 2000, 2003, XP, 2008, and it's definitely worth a look. So Google up PowerShell or Microsoft up PowerShell on their site. It's quite a lot of fun.
Can you run that on an XP workstation or something?
Yes, you can. And in fact, all of the scripting and stuff does work on an XP workstation because all of the remote administrative tools for Windows Server 2008 can also run on XP workstation.
Oh, well, there you go. So some happy Windows XPing for some people to do when, again, there's lots to do. There's lots you can sit there, particularly if you live in Melbourne and you get these miserable wet Sunday afternoons. and you can sort of play around with your computers and learn heaps of stuff that we may not cover or you may have missed in the course. Okay, the Telnet server administration tool is under services. It is under where? Hang on. Let me see, where is it?
Start run services.msc. You can right click on my computer and go manage, and then go down to services down in the tree view there.
Yeah, I found it here in the notes actually. They're going the select start programs administrative tools if it's on that menu, and grab it from. There's plenty of ways to do it. This can only be started and stopped by system administrator, and enabling these Telnet sessions or services represents a potential security issue that you as a network administrator must consider. Because the Telnet server can actually become a backdoor to unauthorized users. Once the Telnet service is activated and running, it can be accessed by accounts that are already created on that machine. So if you're remote and you have an account on that machine, you can telnet into it. So basically, you must be a user that can also log onto the machine locally when you're back at the office. There's a thing called NT LAN Manager. I'm wondering whether Kerry might be better to take over at this point, just for the
brief discussion. There are two types of passwords. One are the clear text passwords that are easily sniffable with a network sniffer. And the other ones are LM hashes, which is the same way that Windows NT encrypts its passwords, or 2000 encrypts its passwords. It essentially does an MD4 hash on the passphrase, but you don't need to know that. The problem with LAN manager passwords is that if you turn them on, generally speaking, Linux versions of the Telnet clients and stuff don't know how to talk LAN man hashes, and they won't let you in. I think Windows Telnet can talk LAN man hashes, but it's not particularly accessible with speech. It sort of works if you do a lot of mouse cursoring, Wii cursoring, JAWS cursoring, or whatever. But it certainly doesn't work with TerraTerm. So you would probably want to turn off those LAN man hashes if you wanted to use third-party Telnet applications that might be accessible to you.
Yep, thanks, Kerry. Okay, now we move into services, and we've already discussed we've installed the Microsoft Internet Information Services. There's many other services that run in the background as well. And if you have a look in Windows XP in particular, you can find that under Administrative Tools. You can see things like running like the themes and causes the blue taskbar down the bottom. There's DHCP services running and DNS services running. I should have actually brought mine up, but have a look in there. They basically allow a system administrator can start and stop each service. So you can actually start and stop the IIS from there.
And the first service I stop under XP, the first service I stop under XP is the security manager. I'm sick and tired of being told I don't have a firewall or that I don't have antivirus. Yes, so
yes, that's a good thing to switch that off.
On personal machines only, don't stop it on other people's machines without their permission, but that stops it bugging you about all sorts of things that it doesn't think you know about. Sometimes, however, it can also be good to start that service up again just in case you want to see what you've missed out on, because it can warn you of potential wobbles and stuff.
You're right. I hope I can be heard. I'm just looking at the services screen now. I was looking at the services screen. So, yeah, basically, you can start, stop, suspend, and do that. And that's a little bit there on services. I don't think there's too much more to talk about really in services, other than consult the notes.
Well, there is another way. There is another way to start and stop services that you might not be aware of, and that is to open up a command prompt and type in /net/start/security center, or /net/start/JFW service with JFW and S in capitals. And in fact, it's actually the JFW service that is responsible for launching JAWS at logon. And you can start and stop those from the command line with the net tool. NetHelp is a good thing to be looking at when you've got one of those wet Sunday afternoons to find out all the interesting things you can do, because there's more to net than just net use and net view.
Now you can also set the, when you're playing around here, you can actually set things to do with these services should they unexpectedly stop. You can actually ask them to restart. You can ask them to run a file. You can ask them to reboot a system, I believe. That would be a bit scary if you set that up on Explorer and it crashed. There's also a dependency tab in there, so it will actually show you what other services the service in question that you're looking at will actually require to run. And we'll see a lot of that in Linux. If you do yum updates and that sort of stuff, I programs under Linux, you'll need to know about some of the dependencies, and most of these operating systems will do a dependency check and tell you about the dependencies that it needs and download those at the same time if they're not already installed. What else we got here? IIS, which we've discussed about. It goes into email here. I don't believe we have to set up email in this, do we, Terry, in this course?
No, and in fact, the email that comes with Windows 2000 is actually Exchange, and we haven't provided you copies of that. You do have to set up email in the practical exam, just a little hint there. You'll be actually installing XM and configuring it, and you're setting up
an IMAP
server.
Aren't you nice?
And,
I think it is, because that's exactly what I need to know. Yes, well, we know how to do that, so I should do rather well at that final exam. Actually, I better not say that. So Kerry will make it harder.
I'll write a special version for you, where you'll have to have your input language set to Kanji. Actually, I think, and I haven't actually checked, but I think the final exam is actually still up on the website. And in fact, there's nothing to stop you from pulling down the practical test right now and studying up all the bits you need so that you can actually do it at the end. We're not actually preventing you from doing that.
Is it the same as last year's, is it?
It should be. I may make some last-minute modifications to it, but last time I looked at it, it looked all right.
A friend of mine warned me of a problem he had with it, which I actually said, well, I did put the domain names in the host file anyway, so it should work. Anyway, that's another story. Okay. But the notes go into talking about the Windows server that we've built, also being able to manage Exchange, as Kerry's just mentioned. And we can put in the notes here how that email is a store and forward service, and it's becoming quite popular in this age of the internet. So basically, the notes tell us about if you're running email, the message is stored on the server until somebody logs in with an email client and retrieves their message. Then goes into talking about email attachments, and I think we've all been around long enough to know what an email is and what an attachment to an email is. So in this way, email services do generally blend in with other file transfer protocols and methods on the internet. In addition to email, the internet has spawned a wide variety of instant messaging services, which are known as real-time services as opposed to store and forward. And we all sit there late at night talking on them and having no life.
In fact, it's quite funny when you step out... when you actually step outside outside our front door and you walk past the next door neighbour's house, sometimes you can hear blub blub blunk or ow, and you know that people are on those instant messenger programs.
Would be MSN. That would be MSN and ICQ.
That's right.
Those sound effects. I don't think anyone ever still used ICQ, but I know MSN's popular.
Well, what we actually do is we don't use ICQ per se, because as soon as you land on ICQ, there's so many quite attractive and desirable girls the world over that would just like your email address and phone number. But if you use something like Jabber, or you use Trillion or for the Windows users, or Bittleby if you're the Linux user, which you can actually hook into it with IRC, you can actually talk on ICQ, AIM, Yahoo, MSN, and Jabber, which includes LJTalk and a few other things, so that a lot of people are using the multi-messenger style programs to do that.
Yeah, they're pretty good, so you don't have to have 50 different programs there. Back to the notes, because we're in our corporate environment here where they don't probably condone their workers sitting there on their instant messaging systems all day, chatting to their friends over the other side of the world.
Although, watch out, because we actually had an interesting case where my sister-in-law works for a law firm, She's turning into one of those sharks. And basically, they banned Facebook, and everybody jumped up and down. Ooh, we cannot exist without Facebook, even though all they were doing on Facebook was playing Scrabulous.
Oh, dear. Oh, no. Yeah, the joys of working for yourself. Well, they're not, actually, because my sister dragged me into Facebook yesterday and sort of wasted an hour of my time looking up what my cousin looks like these days, who I haven't seen for 20 years. Interesting sort of stuff. Any other comments before we get into printing? Because printing is an important part of network services. Okay, the advantages of a node as a network operating system is that we can certainly share out network resources, i.e. printers. Printers can be hooked up to the server and connected to, so that the workstations act as if the printer is directly connected to them. Why would we bother doing this? Why would we not just simply stick a printer on everybody's desk?
Costs.
Exactly. It costs too much money to stick a printer on everybody's desk, so we'd rather pay that money into paying the network administrator to keep them all working for you. So basically, many users...
If you buy one very expensive printer that does stapling and duplexing and all sorts of things, your average Canon bubble fret won't be able to do those sorts of things. And if you've got 50 or 100 of these little printers going on everybody's desktop, not only is the person who's going to re-ink all the cartridges going to go absolutely mad, but you're actually going to spend out, you know, $20 or $30 per colour per cartridge. And the printer manufacturers will get very, very rich, and you will get very, very poor. And then if you put cheap generic ink into your printer and you're not careful about what sort of ink it is, there's actually a good article on the Epson site where they have a picture of somebody putting concrete into their washing machine, and it says, please use the correct ink. I would sort of expand that by saying, please use the correct ink, i.e. know which ones of the dodgy ones are not going to turn your printer into a big rock. So get the good dodgy ink if you're going to go dodgy, because you just decided that you can't afford the really good ink because you shouldn't be printing that much stuff out anyway.
That's right, so careful what you do. You can actually dedicate a whole machine to being a print server. So you simply put your printers, because I've seen print servers in the corporate environment with more than one printer on it, and those printers are shared out in a very similar way to sharing out a folder or a resource or any other resource on the network. Once it becomes a network printer, the clients can then be connected to that printer. And that can be done in two ways, and I've just got to scroll down to those two ways. But basically, if you can see the network, you may have to refer to your notes to this, because I'll end up getting lost in it. You can read up on how to connect to a network shared printer if you know its path.
You can go start run backslash machine name / spool name, or you can actually go through My Network Places and browse for the printer if it shows up in My Network Places. There we go. And it will optionally offer to install print drivers onto your machine. And if you trust the print drivers, you can install them. And if you don't, then you won't. But it will actually offer to install the drivers that you need for that.
That was a feature. It will actually drag the driver off the print server and across to your machine. And I remember back in the bad old days of Windows 95, and I think 98 as well, you had to install a print driver on the local machine and then do your browse. It's actually the network wizard, I think it is. The Ad Printer Wizard is what we were looking for there. I've just scrolled down to the right place in the notes. So, wizards are basically, as the notes say here, are a systematic system of dialog boxes that guides the user through the things they need to do. There's actually a command called the NetUse command. I won't go into it because I don't know how many people use it these days. I think I used it once 10 years ago, and that will capture a printer port.
A lot of people do. The reason you use the NetUse command, and this course is an introduction to network administration. When you are writing login scripts, You will need to use NetUse to connect shared drives, and you will need to use NetUse to connect printers, and you may also need to use NetUse to connect an LPT port for DOS compatibility, because you've got some crusty old legacy application that requires to print to LPT1. So we may not necessarily have to go through it today, but be aware that the NetUse command exists. And one of the things you'll find about administration, especially under Windows 2000, and especially now with core services and all of this PowerShell stuff, administration is going back to the command line, and people are going to administer purely from the command line. In fact, you can pull whole Active Directory schemas in XML in from the command line. And I've actually got a book called Managing Windows Server 2003, yada, 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 from the command line, and it goes through exactly how to do all this stuff. It tells you how to add and remove users and all those sorts of things from the command line, and how to do all sorts of things in Windows XP from the command line that you never knew were possible. There's a treasure trove of little command line utilities that few people even know about. For example, nbtstat. Why isn't that pesty computer showing up on the network? I can't see it in my network places. Well, it's nbtstat to the rescue. That's right, if you have an iota of intelligence, you can dump and examine the NetBIOS name table. What, NetBIOS name table? I don't even know what that is, you say. Well, pay me lots of money, and I'll help you find out why your machine won't show up on the network. So there are lots of little tools that will help people out. And it's very important that, as a blind person especially, that you are aware of these little tools, because you can do things in seconds that other people will be dragging the mouse through a sluggish GUI for hours doing. End advertisement.
There you go. So there you go. Pay Kerry. Oh, no, we shouldn't say that. But I'm getting the idea that it's all back to the command line, because it's people are becoming interested in telecommuting and being able to remote, well, because the LAN no longer refers to the machines in the building that you work in, it's the machines under the administrative control. So therefore, are we talking the command line becoming so popular because people are having to remote admin machines across multiple sites?
Also because I'm assuming that's yes. Administration. Yes, yes, and also assuming that GUI control, as you would well know, whilst it is very, very convenient to kick up a VNC connection to another machine and drag things around, and it's extremely convenient to VNC in and see how your torrents are downloading, it also chews up a lot of network bandwidth. And it's much quicker to get in with a web interface or a command line interface rather than dragging your link down with VNC. Yes. For those of you who haven't checked out VNC, it's completely inaccessible if you can't see, but wonderful if you've got a little bit of sight, you can remote control things.
Yes, even if they happen to be in Darwin when you're in Melbourne. And because I'm privileged enough to have a bit of sight, it's been often a handy tool for training. But as Kerry says, for remote admining, if you can do it via a command line, that is obviously the better way for resources to go. This brings us into our scripting session. We've got a little bit here on scripting. I won't go too much into it, but Kerry did mention log-on scripts and that sort of stuff. Windows will recognise, Windows XP and 2000 will recognise a variety of different scripts, and these can be used to automate certain tasks. I use a backup script on my Linux server because I can't be bothered typing in the appropriate rsync commands and directories every time I want to run my backup. So these are often used by administrators to make repetitive tasks automated. Windows will recognise one or two examples: a JavaScript and Visual Basic Script, or VBS.
And it's actually called JScript now, because Microsoft JScript got in trouble for calling it JavaScript.
They did too. Yeah. Oh, geez. It actually says Java notes. I wonder how old these are. Ooh, there you go. Yes, you're right.
2003.
JScript. I thought all that went on before then, but anyway, maybe I've misread it. Basically, you can actually practice writing a bit of scripting. I don't know whether the Labs get us to do it. I have a feeling they might. But a good example of a script is to crack open a copy of the Windows Notepad and write the command msgbox, message box, quote, hello world, close quote, and save it with a .vbx extension. So rather than saving it with a .txt extension, save it with a .vbx extension, and go with Windows Explorer on my computer and double-click on the file and see the result. The result will actually be a little dialog box, because I tried it, a little dialog box that will pop up with Hello World in it and an OK button. So there you go. So it's a very, very simple example of how to write a Visual Basic
interestingly enough, there are actually some people, and that should work, on most machines, there are some people who actually disable the Windows scripting host, which does cause them all sorts of grief, because there are actually certain viruses that take advantage of the fact that there are these extensions that will actually execute when you double-click on them. So make sure that if you are, that you haven't disabled your scripting host or it won't run.
Yep. And this is pretty much it. So have a play with scripting. We'll also be doing some of that under Linux, where scripting is very, very important. And this is pretty much it. Here endeth the lecture. Just a bit of a review. We've just installed Windows 2000. We've talked about the text-based part of the installation, the graphical part of the installation, and setting up networking. We've talked about the interface of Windows 2000 and XP, and we've talked about today some of the services, the adding and removal of groups and users, and of course we've just talked about a little bit of scripting. So here ended the lesson. Thank you for your attention, and it's probably back to Kerry and Geraldine.
And we're just about to do a quiz soon. The quiz for Module 8. And Geraldine's just talking, so I'll just rabbit on for a bit longer. Rabbit. And we'll be doing the quiz soon. Rabbit. That's okay. I was just making sure, because Trevor was asking you, very important things there. And I'll hand it over to Quiz Mistress Geraldine, who will, I don't know whether she'll whip you into shape or something, but you'll see how many questions we all get right. So let's go.
Da-da-da-da-da-da! Okie-dokie, we have Quiz Mistress, eh? Geraldine Mistress.
You know, change your name to Geraldine McGuire, as in Eddie McGuire.
You can say lock it in, Geraldine.
Okay. All right.
Do we get to phone a friend?
I was about to say that, Elise.
You can do that. We won't mind. Okay. Question one.
I'm just giving a lecture, so I can sit back.
Yeah, and you did very, very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question one. A user wishes to share a local printer with other users on the network. How would the user configure the printer for sharing? Would they do A, Start, Control Panel, Printers, then right-click on the printer name and choose Sharing from the menu? Or would they do B, My Computer, Properties, Printers, Sharing? Or C, My Network Places, Sharing Printers and select the appropriate printer? Or D, open a file and select File, Print, Properties, Enable Sharing.
A.
And I'm just going to go on AutoVox.
Hey.
Yes, you're all correct. Okay, are we running along all right? Good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, question two. What must be done to configure the FTP services for Windows 2000? A, the IIS component must be loaded. B, the user must connect to the server using FTP, C, the network operating system must be reinstalled to include FTP. Or D, the FTP clients group must be created.
D.
One answer, I think, is all we need for this one.
A.
Yeah, one.
And you need to have IIS loaded because FTP server is, and Elise said that.
Hey.
Yes, much the same as installing and setting up the HTTP.
Okay, that's good. It was A. Okay, when installing Windows 2000, the setup wizard will ask for a computer name. What is the maximum number of characters allowed for the computer name? Is it A, 8? B, 15, C, 36, D, 127, E, 255, or F, wouldn't have a clue.
B.
You wouldn't have a clue is a good option, I think.
It is B, 15.
It is B.
That's because the computer name and the type byte is actually a 16-character field, and it's actually word-aligned because you actually have a record type and the actual name type in the NetBIOS name server, something you will never need to know, but there you have it.
Okay, which of the following file systems would be most appropriate for a Windows 2000 disk partition? Is it A, FAT16, B, FAT32, C, NTFS, D, EXT2, or E, EXT3?
C.
All go. That's exactly right, NTFS. Well done. Okay. Which scripting language is widely used in Windows 2000? Is it A, VBScript, B, ShellScript, C, Rex, or D, PerlScript?
Not B.
Okay. Next question. Which level of control does the system administrator have over the network operating system? Is it A, the user account, B, system backup, C, network security, or D, complete control?
D.
Which leads to the quote that is actually seen in Windows NT magazine, which says an NT/Windows 2000 server can be administered by an idiot, and often is.
I like it. Okay. The administrator wants to only allow a user to view the contents of a file and execute a program in Windows 2000. Which of the following permissions should be set? Okay. Is it A, write, B, read, C, execute, D, full control, or
D?
Need to.
B and C. D.
Okay, guys, they want to be able to read and they want to be able to execute, which would be B and C, I think you'll find.
B and C.
Yeah, B and C is the thing you want.
Okay, next question. Which of the following commands will enable users to discover the IP configuration of a Windows XP computer? Is it A, ping, space localhost, B, ipconfig/all, or C, ifconfig, or D, netstat?
D, is it D?
We can't actually tell you until everybody else has answered, sorry.
I've forgotten which goes which. I was nearly going to write it in, but I won't bother.
C apostrophe.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
Okay, so yeah, can anybody want to type in the command that would do it?
I will.
Pardon. Ifconfig all. Question PL.
So on.
IP config okay, slash all, I forgot which letter it went with.
No, that's okay. B is IP config slash all.
Yeah.
Yep. And we have a question from Enable. And they've either got a question PL, so I assume they're not asking the question in Perl. But we'll wait for the question. Oh, we're past that one, guys. It's which command. Which command will give you the IP configuration on a Windows XP workstation? A, ping 127.0.0.1. B, ipconfig/all. C, ifconfig. Or D, netstat.
It was ipconfig/all.
And the answer was B, ipconfig/all.
Very handy command. Gives you loads of information.
Well, actually, you'll fail your labs if you don't use it, so you'll...
Yeah, well, I had to use it last night to work out where my DHCP sent my virtual machine to.
The other way to work out where your virtual machine has been sent is to actually... There is actually a file in the... application data VMware that actually has a list of VMware leases, and you can actually look at that file. There's actually documentation in the instructions so that you can find your Linux machine in case you can't see the screen on the actual guest. You can actually look in that file and it'll show you the leases that have been handed out by VMware.
I'm showing you that on the host machine, I assume.
Yes, there's a file on the host machine that holds all of the leases that the DHCP server has handed out.
I was wondering how you were getting around that.
Yeah, well, it's actually in VMware underline instructions.html, which you should have grabbed the latest version of.
It's the one that Jim had marked up last week.
Yes, that's right. And it's actually got information there to tell you how to get the IP addresses of your virtual machines without looking at the screen of the guest.
Cool.
Now, I'm going to do this next question as a yes-no one, okay, because they're asking yes-no. So which of the following passwords are considered unacceptable? A, SCOP, SCOP.
No.
N, no, N.
Net, for, the figure, for, work.
N. No.
I think you find that's actually a yes.
I suppose because it's got some numbers and words and letters in it, I suppose it's sort of,
And it's long enough.
You can say.
We're saying unacceptable. So in actual fact, Scott, in other words, not a very secure one. Right?
And what was B? Was it listed as unacceptable?
With number four, work, and it's acceptable, yes. Ethernet. The word, Ethernet.
No. No.
That's correct. Cisco, CISCO with a number 5 after it.
Yes, why, no.
It gets a bit subjective here. According to them, it's good enough. They've cracked our password scheme. I'd be tempted to put more uppercase and a few other things in the... because you guessed it, guys. The first thing that the password algorithms will do now when they're guessing passwords is take a dictionary word and stick a number on the end of it.
Numerals, 1-4. Lowercase a, uppercase f, lowercase T-A-P with an exclamation mark.
Why? Yes. Why?
And according to Graham, we've got 3 acceptables, so we can stop here.
Oh, can I do another 2?
Oh, why not?
I'll throw another 2 in just to be difficult. A in lowercase, 55 figures.
Why?
Bit short.
Why?
No, it's too short, guys. It's got to be at least 5 letters long.
Okay.
How about T-O-P-A-Z?
Well, I was thinking P-O-G-G-Y. Yeah, could I have a password of Topaz?
Can if you want it cracked. No, that Geraldine, we know who Topaz. Let's try it and see. Oh, we're in. Oh, wow, we're Geraldine. We've got admin rights. Let's go.
I can tell you it isn't that. No, something that's associated with you, like a dog's name, as we mentioned earlier, his name or your child, whatever, is going to get cracked pretty quick. That brings us to the end of all of that Module 8. How are we all feeling? Do we want to do a bit of 9 or...?
We'll see what they say. We've been through a fair bit.
Is everyone feeling a bit...
Maybe this would be a good opportunity for people to get started on those labs that are all sitting up there on the website. Because you've got 2 weeks to get into those labs and probably going to have... tomorrow we have a Thursday chat from Sean Murphy, who's finally got his stuff together and managed to get the time off work, which is the complicated thing, and he's going to be talking about what it's like to work at Cisco in North Sydney. So that's the Thursday chat for tomorrow at 11.
And just to let you know that Module 9, actually, it's probably is a good spot to stop, is about Linux installations, so I think we will leave that couple of weeks.
It's a good breaking point.
Catch up on your labs because you're going to need to know.
Just for the Windows installation people out there, there is a very good lab by Kerry Hoth last year in the lab himself installing Ubuntu. Or was it Debian?
Ubuntu, I think we did, didn't we?
Yeah, I think I can't remember which one. Did it with a serial cable.
You did it with a null modem cable. Yeah, it was one of the things you did last year. It's a very good lab. It'll get you going into Linux. It'll sort of wean you into it a bit. I've listened to it.
Last year, as Elise is mentioning, because there is a lot of stuff up there.
That's partly how I know what's to come. That's why I opted to present the Lecture 8, because I was more confident in doing it when I was asked to do it. So, yeah, have a listen ahead, because not much more to go, actually. Is there? Was it only up to 11, isn't it? 12 or something?
14 in IT.
Oh, it's 14. Modules. It's 14, is it?
Okay. Oh, but boy, there's some labs between now and 14, let me tell you. And there are a lot of labs. But absolutely, and in fact, I really encourage people to look into last year's labs and stuff, because we did do some demonstrations of how to install things. And in fact, we also did one where I was helping people over Ventrilo actually telnetting into their Debian boxes and stuff and actually teaching them how to use Ed. I have to find that was... I think that was one of the first chats, actually.
I think Ed was done in the actual installation. Well, I could be wrong. I remember hearing it. It's there. Yeah.
Do you remember that one, Gemma, when we had Rick and Dean and everybody on, and we all fired up our virtual machines and bashed the keyboard?
Actually, that was a separate one, I think. Chat. Yeah, no, there was. It's a good one.
Those Thursday chats are really gold. They really do have a lot of really good information in them. Not just because I present a lot of them, although obviously that has a big thing to do with it, but we actually do have a lot of information that you otherwise wouldn't get if you didn't listen to those Thursday chats. And in fact, one of the ones we'd strongly point you at is the one we did on research methods earlier this year. Not pointing any fingers per se, but a lot of the questions we see on the Cavi Discuss mailing list could actually be answered by a few short seconds in Google feeding in the right terms, and we have a Thursday chat to help you out with that on research methods, so do take a look at that.
Yeah.
We will be around, so don't, we are here on Skype.
Has anyone had problems with virtual machines and JAWS and stuff running and getting control and shift and everything hooked?
There is a JAWS script that fixes that if you're running Workstation, and that will actually let the shift keys and stuff release. The VMware.jss will work with VMware Workstation. The script hasn't been modified to work with VMware Server, although perhaps it could be, and that will actually stop the Control and Alt and Shift keys from locking down when you ungrab.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done by Sean Murphy, one of our students who previously worked for Freedom Science Fiction. Yep, that's it.
Everyone, have a good one.